Hello, and welcome to Ordinary Philosophy Podcast. Here, you can listen to interviews and audio renditions of pieces published at Ordinary Philosophy's website, dedicated to philosophy in the public square and the history of ideas that change the world. For more about Ordinary Philosophy, and to see the photographs and the sources and inspiration for each piece, please visit ordinaryphilosophy.com. I'm Amy Cools, creator and editor of Ordinary Philosophy. Please excuse the delay in my putting out podcasts and actually my travel series when I traveled across the U.S. from Washington State, across the Bitterroot Mountains, and heading east through Native American country. I have been at the University of Edinburgh, as many of you know, and I've also been catching just about every cold that has been going around here. I think my immune system is not used to these international viruses yet. So it's delayed my podcasting and also my research to give you more information about the places I saw and visited, both the cold and also, of course, my studies. I'm working on my master's degree here at the University of Edinburgh, which is a most wonderful experience. I'm having a great time. Unfortunately, though, it means I've had to neglect my research for this travel series. But anyway, I hope to get back to it in earnest before long. I want to spend some of my holiday season catching up. So without further ado, let me introduce this next episode, which is looking back to the end of July. It is episode 101, Wounded Knee, Pine Ridge Reservation, South Dakota. Afternoon and evening of July 25th, 2017. From McLaughlin, Standing Rock Reservation in South Dakota, I make the five-hour drive south to my next destination in the Pine Ridge Reservation, just a little ways north of the Nebraska border. My drive takes me through Badlands National Park, though only for a short while. What I see of it is beautiful, and I certainly plan to return. My destination is Wounded Knee, named for Wounded Knee Creek and the site of a conflict between the United States Army and the band of Chief Spotted Elk, or Bigfoot, as the U.S. Army dubbed him. This conflict was originally called the Battle of Wounded Knee in United States historical accounts, but was generally redesignated the Massacre of Wounded Knee. As sympathy for the plight of defeated Native Americans grew and their side of the story became better known, it became clear that massacre was a more fitting term for this affair than battle, since the vast majority of those who were shot down here were non-combatants, women, children, infants, and the elderly. When I arrive at the large red and white sign at the side of the road which marks the Wounded Knee Massacre site, I park at the little lot in front of it. I look a while at the structures and the lay of the land here for a while. I take some pictures and then begin to read the sign, front and back. Here's what the front and the back of the sign say. It's titled, Massacre of Wounded Knee. December 29th, 1890, Chief Bigfoot, with his Minneconju and Hunkpapa Sioux band of 106 warriors, 250 women and children, were encamped on this flat, surrounded by the U.S. 7th Cavalry, of 470 soldiers, commanded by Colonel Forsyth. The Messiah craze possessed many Indians who left the vicinity of the agencies to ghost dance during the summer and fall of 1890. Unrest, that's in quotes, on the Pine Ridge Reservation was partly due to the reduction of beef rations by Congress and to the ghost dancing of Chiefs Sitting Bull, Hump, Bigfoot, Kicking Bear, and Short Bull. The Sioux were told by Kicking Bear and Short Bull that by wearing ghost shirts, the ghost dancing warriors would become immune to the white man's bullets and could openly defy the soldiers and white settlers and bring back the old days of the big buffalo herds. On November 15th, 1890, Indian agent Royer in Lakota Wokokpa at Pine Ridge called for troops, and by December 1st, 1890, several thousand U.S. regulars were assembled in this area of Dakota Territory. On December 15, 1890, Chief Sitting Bull was killed by Lieutenant Bullhead of the Standing Rock Indian Police. 40 of Sitting Bull's braves escaped from Grand River and joined Chief Bigfoot's band on Deep Creek to camp and ghost dance on the South Fork of the Cheyenne River. Chief Bigfoot was under close scrutiny of Lieutenant Colonel Sumner and his troops, and on December 23, 1890, they were ordered to arrest Bigfoot as a hostile. However, the Bigfoot band had already silently slipped away from the Cheyenne County into the Badlands, heading for Pine Ridge. On December 28, 1890, without a struggle, Chief Bigfoot surrendered to the U.S. 7th Cavalry, to Major Whitesides, at the site marked by a sign 5 miles north of here. The band was then escorted to Wounded Knee, camping that night under guard. Reinforcements of the U.S. 7th Cavalry, including one company of Indian Scouts, arrived at Wounded Knee from Pine Ridge Agency the morning of December 29, 1890. Colonel Forsyth took command of a force of 470 men. A battery of 4 Hotchkiss guns was placed on the hill 400 feet west of here, overlooking the Indian encampment. Bigfoot's band was encircled at, and that's the end of that side, here's the second side, 9 a.m. by a line of foot soldiers and cavalry. Chief Bigfoot, sick with pneumonia, lay in a warmed tent provided by Colonel Forsyth in the center of the camp. A white flag flew there, placed by the Indians. Directly in the rear of the Indian camp was a dry draw, running east and west. The Indians were ordered to surrender their arms before proceeding to Pine Ridge. Captain Wallace, with an army detail, began searching the teepees for hidden weapons. During this excitement, Yellowbird, a medicine man, walked among the braves, blowing on an eagle bone whistle, inciting the warriors to action, declaring that the ghost shirts worn by the warriors would protect them from the soldiers' bullets. A shot was fired, and all hell broke loose. The troops fired a deadly volley into the council warriors, killing nearly half of them. A bloody hand-to-hand struggle followed, all the more desperate since the Indians were armed mostly with clubs, knives, and revolvers. The Hotchkiss guns fired 2-pound explosive shells on the group, indiscriminately killing warriors, women, children, and their own disarming soldiers. Soldiers were killed by crossfire of their comrades in this desperate engagement. Surviving Indians stampeded in wild disorder for the shelter of the draw 200 feet to the south, escaping west and east in the draw, and north down Wounded Knee Creek. Pursuit by the 7th Cavalry resulted in the killing of more men, women, and children, causing this battle to be referred to as the Wounded Knee Massacre. 1 hour later, 146 men, women, and children lay dead in Wounded Knee Creek Valley. The bodies of many were scattered along a distance of 2 miles from the scene of the encounter. 20 soldiers were killed on the field, and 16 later died of wounds. Wounded soldiers and Indians alike were taken to Pine Ridge Agency. A blizzard came up. 4 days later, an army detail gathered up the Indian dead and buried them in a common grave at the top of the hill northwest of here. A monument marks this grave. Ghost dancing ended with this encounter. The Wounded Knee battlefield is a site of the last armed conflict between the Sioux Indians and the United States Army. And a note, someone crossed out last, because here in Wounded Knee, that's open to dispute. I'm not yet finished when a young man approaches me, perhaps 15 or so. He is lean, about my height, with hair pulled back and hanging long behind. He's dressed simply in a plain t-shirt and jeans. His skin is a rich reddish-golden tan in the deep peach just after sunset light, his cheekbones high. "That sign is wrong," he says. "They tell the story wrong." "Hello, and thanks for the warning," I reply. "Who are they?" He tells me that the people who agree with the army side of things wrote the sign. I interject and tell him, yes, I see where they placed a wood block on each side to cover part of the title, painted with the replacement word, massacre. But, he explains, they still didn't really fix most of what's wrong with it. Bigfoot was not really the chief's name and, well, the whole thing is wrong. He tells me why. Then he points to the colorfully painted round building across the road. "Go to the museum. That's our museum, where we tell the story," he directs me. "I will," I said. "That's where I'm headed next. But I do want to finish reading the whole sign and see what they say about it, and then try to find out the real story if I can." I return to the back of the sign, read the rest carefully, then approach him again. "I know what they say here now, so I'll go to the museum and read the story there." "Okay," he says, then hesitates a moment. Then he holds up some beaded necklaces in different bright colors, each with a circular pendant holder open in the center to display the gemstone or colorful glass bead within. "I make these," he says. I admire them, and he names their prices. "I'm sorry," I tell him. "I can check to see what I have, but I remember I don't have much cash on me, not nearly enough to pay you fairly for all this work." "I take contributions," he says. I go to the car and check, and it's true, I only have a few dollars. I take most of this and bring it back to him. "Thanks for telling me the story, and I'll go find out more." I cross the road. In 1890, the Lakota people were not doing well. They had mostly been driven from their homelands, scattered and confined to reservations in unfamiliar and mostly inhospitable territories. U.S. government-issued rations, supplied by treaty agreement, were scarce, sometimes in punishment for real or perceived infractions, and more often because corrupt and underpaid government agents and dishonest contract suppliers skimmed liberally from the top. So, the Lakota often went hungry. They were often disarmed, too, so they could not always defend their holdings from white raiders or go on raids themselves when hunger or honor demanded it. The dispossessed men could sometimes get special dispensations from the army to get their guns back for hunting, but the hunting was poor. The white settlers had also nearly wiped the American buffalo from the face of the earth, in part for their hides, which made fashionable hats and other goods, and in part to remove the incentive for Great Plains Indians to want to remain in their traditional hunting grounds. Deer, elk, and other game were getting ever harder to find, too, and their lean meat was not as nutritious. Boredom, disillusionment, depression, and disease were also rampant. The traditional ways of life that gave it meaning were gone, and the men, especially, had little to do and little reason to want to do it. Much of the reservation lands were not very good for farming, even when some of the Lakota decided to take up this culturally undesirable occupation. It was traditionally acceptable for women, but not for men. And bad land apportionment policies caused many Native American-owned ranches to fail. Children who were sent to white schools by their parents, or taken from their parents when they were unwilling, were shorn of their hair, traditionally worn long, and whipped when they dared speak a word of their native language or engage in any traditional ways. The unfamiliar terrain, often assigned as reservations precisely because their poor soil and malarial conditions made them undesirable to white settlers, helped contribute to the depression and disease that regularly wiped out large portions of Native American populations, who were already vulnerable to the diseases introduced by white people, to which they had little or no immunity. And when Native Americans of the Great Plains and throughout America, as individuals or groups, dared to leave their poor circumstances in the reservations and strike out for a better life for themselves and their families, just as the white settlers had done when heading west, they were branded hostiles and hunted down like criminals. In 1890, the Minneconjou Lakota chief Spotted Elk welcomed two distressed Hunkpapa Lakota men into his camp in the Cheyenne River Reservation, just south of Standing Rock. They bore the sad tidings of the killing of his half-brother, Sitting Bull, and some of his followers who adhered to the Ghost Dance movement. About 40 more of Sitting Bull's band were set to flee Standing Rock, fearing they'd be next. White authorities thought that because the Ghost Dance cult believed sacred garments called ghost shirts could turn away bullets, this implied that their wearers secretly plotted war against the whites, though the Ghost Dance cult actually, explicitly, preached nonviolence. Like Sitting Bull, Spotted Elk was initially drawn to the Ghost Dance movement, but later rejected its truth and utility, though they both tolerated adherence in the cult by others. After all, it revived a spirit of hope and purpose in its adherents, and it preached peace. But this made both Lakota leaders objects of suspicion by the white authorities, who apparently believed that once a ghost dancer, always a ghost dancer. In solidarity and a spirit of brotherly hospitality, Spotted Elk invited the beleaguered and bereft Hunkpapas of the slain Sitting Bull's band to take shelter with his own. Spotted Elk had become a trusted negotiator by white and Native American authorities by this time. He was an uncle of the great warrior Crazy Horse, Oglala hero of the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and an ally of the rebellious tribes in the Great Sioux Wars of the 1870s, but had remained a peaceful moderate in dealing with white demands for many years since then, settling down and farming on the reservation. By the time of Sitting Bull's death in the spring of 1890, however, white and Native Americans alike had begun to view the 65-year-old Spotted Elk as, at best, out of touch and somewhat irrelevant, and, at worst, a secret ghost dance anti-white conspirator. So when white authorities heard that the ghost dance Hunkpapas were with Spotted Elk, they believed that their suspicions of impending rebellion were confirmed. They wanted Spotted Elk arrested too, along with the Hunkpapa refugees. But the peaceful Spotted Elk, who didn't want to betray these men, couldn't convince the young men of his band to give up the Hunkpapas anyway. When he heard that troops were on their way, Spotted Elk decided it was useless to try to give in to these unreasonable demands and expose himself to unreasonable arrest. He decided to lead his band south to Pine Ridge instead, to answer to a request by Chief Red Cloud to mediate some difficulties there. Before he left, however, he fell terribly ill with pneumonia. He made this trek south with his people, carried in a litter, coughing up blood and growing ever weaker along the way. It was dead winter, late December, and they struggled through the snow, wind, and bitter cold. Though the local army authority didn't believe Spotted Elk and his people were a threat, they were ordered to intercept and detain them. U.S. Army troops caught up with Spotted Elk and his people not far from Wounded Knee Creek, where they proceeded on to camp and arrange for talks. But the talks did not go well. They began with the order from far away higher-ups to disarm the band. Spotted Elk refused. The band needed to be able to protect themselves out here away from the Pine Ridge Agency, and they needed to hunt and provide their families with food in these hard times. The protracted and repeated bargaining and forced attempts to convince Spotted Elk's men to give up their weapons became more and more contentious. It was just too humiliating for a man to be forced to give up his most expensive and prized possession, his main tool and weapon with which he could vanquish his enemies, protect his life and those of his people, and provide for his family and friends. Sometimes the Minneconjou would make a show of giving up weapons by turning in their old and broken ones. Sometimes the soldiers would simply raid the tents and take the hidden weapons, pushing past the enraged and resisting women as they did so. This whole business of forcibly and unnecessarily disarming the band was not a policy that the local military authorities thought wise or necessary. But the orders came in insistently, so they obeyed. Francis Craft, the Jesuit priest who lived with the Lakota people and spoke their language, assisted with these sticky negotiations. It's a map from his papers, by the way, that I used as an aid in seeking the site of Sitting Bull's death. On December 29th, 1890, the Minneconjou men were called out to be thoroughly searched and all their firearms confiscated once and for all. When a rather clueless soldier tried to grab and wrest a gun from the hands of a deaf and perhaps mentally troubled man, a shot went off. It was all over then. The shots kept firing, and the killing began. And went on and on. Both sides shot some from their own number in the crossfire, and both sides fought at first. But when it became clear that the badly outnumbered Minneconjou were losing, the killing kept going, segueing from combat to simple extermination. Soldiers, in a cold, relentless sort of frenzy, began methodically picking off the fleeing Minneconjou one by one, aiming, shooting to kill all of those that the Hotchkiss guns didn't get. When the firing finally stopped, about 24 soldiers were killed and about 40 wounded. But unlike what that old sign says, between 250 and 300 of Spotted Elk's people were killed, more than 2/3 of them women, children, and other non-combatants. Spotted Elk was among them. I entered the Wounded Knee Museum and find myself in an open, roughly circular room. There's a long folding table with a guest book, a little cash box, and some papers. Behind it stands a young woman in a long dark-colored dress without sleeves, her long hair loosely pulled back. She's rather petite, slim, with a round face and flushed cheeks. I greet her. She seems remote, almost out of it, and answers me in a voice so quiet I don't catch all of what she says. She does indicate that I should look around, so I do. There's a pair of child's sparkly blue costume fairy wings in the center of the floor, and a few other toys. I find that the displays mostly consist of texts and images painted on the wall and printed on large sheets, some framed, that sit atop more folding tables that line the room. They don't refer much to the first clash at Wounded Knee, but to the second from the 1970s, in the midst of the American Indian movement. That's a long and important story of its own, too much to get into for this piece. The displays also tell stories of other important moments in the struggle for Native American rights. And here, on the website's version of this story, there's photos of many of the displays at the Wounded Knee Museum, and I encourage you to take a look at it. Or you can just go look up the American Indian Movement and see what you can find. I would encourage you to look at various sources because, of course, different sides of the story tell it very differently. I leave the museum and am just about to walk up the hill when two very small children run up to me. A little girl, perhaps 3, hugs my legs, and her wide grin displays her tiny upper teeth. She has wispy pigtails and wears a pink play dress. She evidently wants to play, but doesn't speak. Her little companion, a ruddy-faced toddler in a blue t-shirt and a diaper, chases after her, his tough little feet undeterred by the gravel. Once she hops and then runs away, looking back an invitation for a good chase. Then he grabs my legs in turn and looks up. His short hair sticks out all around his head. They are impish and adorable. I've always particularly liked bold and precocious children. Not bratty, mind you, but outgoing. I greet them and smile, and since the little girl doesn't answer what I say to her, just continues to invite me to play with gestures and body language, I'm not sure if she understands me. The lady from the museum calls to the children, and after a few moments of stalling, they run inside. I continue up the hill to the burial ground, the cemetery gate composed of an unpretentious arch of metal across 2 pillars of brick painted red and white. It's surmounted by a simple cross. There are many gravestones, and a handsome engraved marble monument that was erected in 1903. I'm about to take my camera out to take pictures for this piece when I see that there are other visitors here standing over grave sites, some speaking to each other softly, some silent, too evidently praying. It doesn't seem respectful, somehow, to take pictures while these people are having the solemn moment here, so I refrain. I'm certain to find some photos published in a public forum later for reference, since this is an important historical site. The burial ground is located on the very hill that the Hotchkiss guns were placed to mow the Oglalas down in their village, sparing no one. But it wasn't just the distant artillery that lacked discretion in whom it killed. Oglala survivors tell of soldiers who deliberately shot women, children, and infants at point-blank range. Many of the soldiers believed that this indiscriminate killing was justified as a preemptive strike. And besides, just as Native Americans were not legal citizens or even persons under U.S. law, so were they considered on a moral basis. They were thought by many as a sort of species of subhuman, in a similar sense that Africans and their descendants were. They were just human enough to accept favors from and treat kindly when it was more expedient to do so, and just human enough to have sex with, at least with the women, with their consent if you could get it, but if not, no matter. But they were not quite human enough to deserve representation in court, not human enough to judge each Native American as a moral individual deserving the benefit of the doubt or of the right to enjoy liberty in their own way. There were, to be sure, some soldiers who did not get caught up in the rush for violence. Some believed and went on to report that the Lakota were being treated unfairly, and in fact, this affair was little short of mass murder, a wholly unnecessary result of bad policy informed by ill-formed and bigoted higher-ups who didn't know or care much about what was happening on the ground. General L.W. Colby was one of those who believed that Wounded Knee was a murderous debacle. A few soldiers had rescued and shielded some of the Lakota, especially women and children. A few survivors were rescued from the frozen battlefield later, including a few infants pulled from the arms of their dead or dying mothers. One of these, Zintkala Nuni, or Lost Bird, was adopted by Colby. Perhaps he saw this adoption as an opportunity to undo a tiny bit of the wrong done. He also seemed to perceive himself as a sort of white knight to this tiny damsel in distress. Unfortunately, Colby's dismay at what happened to the Lakota at Wounded Knee didn't translate into his being a very good caretaker later to this one particular Lakota. He abandoned Lost Bird and her adoptive mother when she was still a child. She was put in white schools, but was never accepted by her white peers. Yet she was forbidden by her doting but unwise adoptive mother to associate with children of her own or of other races either. She wanted Lost Bird to be an example of her brand of progressivism, to show that Native Americans could be as perfectly civilized as anyone else if you just assimilate them properly. But Lost Bird never adjusted well to white culture in general and struggled to get by as an adult, mostly working as a traveling performer. She had many troubled relationships, some of which were abusive, and Colby had her institutionalized in a harsh reformatory when she became pregnant at 17. She contracted syphilis from her first husband and suffered from it for the rest of her life. Already weakened by this disease, Lost Bird died at only age 29 in an influenza epidemic in 1920. Her body was reclaimed by her people and reburied here at Wounded Knee in the burial ground on the hill. Ordinary Philosophy's website and podcast are independent and ad-free, and depend on support from patrons and listeners like you. To find out more about how you can contribute to Ordinary Philosophy, please visit the Subscribe, Submit, and Support page today. And if you enjoy what you read and hear at Ordinary Philosophy, please share with those you believe will enjoy it too, and take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes. And thank you, as always, for listening.